All right, so just as a recap, right before we left off last lecture, we had essentially applied some of the stuff that we learned about binary evolution in under gravitational radiation, sort of in the simplest possible case, where we essentially just had a weak field expression for luminosity and gravitational waves, and we adjusted Newtonian dynamics with that for an equal mass binary system. And I'd been saying all along that even though it certainly is going to break down when the system was moving at relativistic speeds, and it didn't include all the physics that can actually affect compact binary waveforms, in actual fact, we found out that applying a basic result from it to real LIGO data turned out pretty well. And so just to recap, the formula that we had derived, which I admit was kind of a strange-looking formula, but it was a formula that related chert mass for some period. So interpreted as like for a chert mass measurement happening at each cycle in a gravitational waveform. So I denotes the cycle. It's approximately 0.015. I use this capital TI. I'll explain it again in a second. And then PI, which I'll also explain. So units of seconds. And you have to convert to solar masses, so, you know, good luck with that. But the idea here is that if you have a gravitational waveform, you can see like this in the data, and you define some coalescence in a reasonable way, like when the gravitational radiation starts to shut off, you work yourself backwards from that point for every period, so every cycle, like I've highlighted here, these bold black lines, you're going to keep track of two numbers. You're going to keep track of the time from the merger backwards as a cumulative number, that's what's shown here, and you're also going to keep track of the actual time of the period. Using those two numbers, you can come up with estimates for the chert mass from every period independently and average them together and get a sense of what the chert mass of the waveform is. We did that yesterday, and at least some of you came up with 30 solar masses. The actual answer is 30.4 solar masses. So came out pretty accurately. Now, before you conclude that this is all you would ever need to do for LIGO data analysis, we probably got a little bit lucky in the sense that maybe if we repeated that in a different signal, it wouldn't come out quite as well, but honestly, probably within 10 or 20%. And B, this particular signal really is a shining example of the best that nature has to offer. And so we're gonna talk about, you know, next today, what we actually have to do in general in LIGO to pull signals out of data, and why, you know, typically this is not adequate. So any questions on this before we jump into that? Because it's kind of a different topic. Yeah?
There's a kind of blue, no black overlying dotted line there. And there's one of those underneath of the black line.
That was me trying to figure out the relationship between pixels and milliseconds.
Okay.
Using GIMP, yeah.
Is this similar with also the noise included? Right.
This is actual data. This is not synthesized. Here you are seeing LIGO data, period. The only thing that's been done to this data is that it has been bandpass filtered, which is something that maybe some of you at least have some sense of. And what that means is that very low and very high frequencies were cut out. But that's a sort of standard signal processing technique if you want to isolate a given region. For LIGO, you've probably already learned, you know, the most sensitive region is right around 100 hertz, 150 hertz. And so in some sense, you know, if you sort of bandpass between, say, 50 and 250 or 50 and 350, that's going to really give you most of your signal content. So I think this was bandpassed between 50 and 350. But other than that, it's completely raw data. Anything else? All right. if you wouldn't mind pulling the screen up. Okay. Thank you. Okay, so how do we actually pull parameters out of data? So I'll start with sort of the biggest picture, top level thing, which probably people have seen in other contexts. So in LIGO, when we actually want to extract physics from our waveforms, the sort of final step that we take to do that before we publish results is reasonably standard practice in Bayesian inference. So I'm not going to go real deep into this, but I just want to give people a sense of how this works. I'll explain what these are here in a second. This is literally first just going to be Bayes' theorem. But I'll explain specifically what the terms mean. Okay, so our goal when we have a gravitational wave signal is to figure out the parameters of that signal. And so in general, the signal parameters will be many. And so what do I mean by that? Well, in the case that we've talked about up until now, it's just been the mass. Like our simplest possible case, it was literally just one mass because we said that the binary was equal mass and we had the simplest possible physical scenario. That's the only free parameter, right? If we're letting it evolve under gravity and gravitational wave emission, like once you pin down the mass, it just does what it does. I mean, in principle, like you have a initial configuration or whatever, but you know, by the time it gets into LIGO, the only thing we're really measuring is the mass. We didn't really derive it yesterday, but we said that the eccentricity wouldn't be important for sources like that. So in this case, lambda is normally the vector of parameters. But it could just be, for example, lambda is just one parameter, so a scalar that is, you know, either mass or trip mass or something like that. In general, it's going to be a lot more than that. So even for black holes, which are still the simplest possible systems in most ways because they don't have, black holes in isolation are extremely simple objects. You have two parameters to determine a black hole, its mass and its spin. That's it. Charge, but that's likely not to be relevant. Astrophysics. When you put two black holes together, there are more parameters as you might imagine. The sort of important ones of course they can have different masses. We're going to assume they're still in circular orbits. The black holes can have spins, but since they're not in isolation, the spin direction, of course, matters. The spin direction of one black hole with respect to the other and both black holes with respect to the orbital angular momentum matters. So you could have a black hole with spins that are like this, for example, and we would say that this is S2. It's, since it's a vector to define not only the magnitude but the direction, it has three components. And then if you imagine thinking about the total angular momentum in that system, you actually, of course, have an angular momentum that if you were to add the orbital angular momentum, which is, you know, described by the plane of the orbit of the two objects, maybe this L here, but plus the spin angular momentum, you could get, in principle, an angular momentum, total angular momentum, J, that's different. And that additional J is not a new free parameter. The additional L is not a new free parameter. But I'm pointing it out because this already leads to some interesting dynamics. So in this system, we only have 8 parameters that I've really put on the board, 3 spin parameters for each black hole and 2 masses. But already you can get in a situation where the total angular momentum and the orbital angular momentum are offset from one another by some angle. Call it theta. I think it's probably usually called phi. I don't remember. It's a typical angle that that's called in GR. But anyway, some angle that these things can differ by, and I'm not going to attempt to show how any of this really works, but to give you a qualitative sense, what might you think would happen if you've got angles like this that are a little bit off in other systems in physics? You can get precession, yeah. So in actual fact, this system already, which is pretty simple and relevant astrophysically, can lead to a situation where you can have a precession of the orbital angular momentum around the total angular momentum, which over short periods doesn't really change. It is radiated, but over short periods is relatively constant, so you get sort of a standard precession problem. And the orbital angular momentum precessing around the total angular momentum means that for some observer, the orbital plane would actually be tilting as it evolves. And although we didn't get into really that much about how angle dependence matters for gravitational wave emission, we did see one formula for the gravitational waveform where the inclination angle came into the amplitude. So that was the one expression that we just wrote down yesterday. And so you could already imagine the situation like this. If you've got a system that's kind of wobbling, you're going to get an amplitude variation. It shouldn't be surprising that this additional physics also leads to changes in the phase evolution of the binary also. And so the only phase evolution that we've talked about, which is basically like the thing that shows up in our cosine and sine of the waveform, has just been driven by this simple parameter chert mass. But in actual fact, that's a function of all of these parameters. And it's messy. Super messy. And you know, it took people in the first iteration just kind of going to the first corrections for simple systems years and years and years. And it's still an extremely important topic in the gravitational wave sector of GR. In the end, the full dynamics can sort of be solved on supercomputers and extracted, but it's still difficult to get really long, complete simulations that pin down gravitational waveforms for as many cycles as LIGO can see them. So all I really want to say about that is just that, in general, the binary system has a lot more parameters than just mass. They all are going to affect the gravitational waveform. Because they affect the gravitational, you could imagine, if you knew everything, sort of repeating the exercise about counting cycles and figuring out how that all works and mapping that onto the best fit in a higher dimensional space. Of course, that becomes an extremely daunting task, but that's why we leverage more sophisticated techniques to do it. All right, yes.
I think there was some really some parentheses in the algorithm
case law. I'm doing
PD, that parentheses to be like probability of D.
Yes, thank you.
And the second thing is that you've got the vector parameters layer and you have the probability of your parameters.
Yes.
Assuming that means it's the probability of any particular sort of values for those parameters.
Yes.
But is there any way of saying probability that my parameters, like my choice of parameters, my parameter space, is correct?
Yeah, so I'm going to get on to that, well, sort of get on to that in just a second. So let's talk about what all of these mean. So we're ultimately interested in, so let me define what these are. So I've defined lambda. So D is just our data. And here it's really helpful to just visualize like the picture that I handed out yesterday, right? Imagine you're handed that wave. Right, like that's data. That's literally what we mean by this. And of course, you know, LIGO has more data than just that. You would repeat this process for all little bits of data in some sense. I'll talk more about that later. So D is what you've got coming out of LIGO. And what we're interested in is figuring out lambda. Now, we already did that yesterday. Now, the way we did that was not quite this sophisticated, but this is literally what we did yesterday. We came up with at least a point estimate for chert mass, which is one of the parameters we're trying to measure, by looking at the data. And I'm not going to go deeply into Bayes' theorem or anything like that. That's not really the point. But in actual fact, what we typically have to worry about when we're doing this inference, of course, as you've already pointed out, is that we have a reasonable prior space on what lambdas can be. So for the case of the binary black hole, we almost have a complete description of the sort of eight parameters that are on that board. But in actual fact, even in our present inferences, we make a few simplifying assumptions. And oftentimes we make the simplifying assumption that the spins of the binary black holes are only aligned with the orbital angular momentum exactly. And I want to just point this out because, you know, in principle, we could keep expanding lambda, and it can get very complicated if we have systems that are more complicated than black holes. For example, neutron stars. I mean, neutron stars are still relatively simple objects, but they are matter. They are extended. The details of the equation of, say, the neutron star, for example, can come into how exactly the dynamics work out. So lambda could be this enormous thing. But in the end, we pick some particular space of possible parameters that we believe is reasonable and proceed with the inference. If we're missing something, we'll end up with a biased result. I'm not going to really talk about that, but I want people to generally be aware that these are issues that are important for the field. Okay, so on to how we would do this. The P of D given lambda is really what we can evaluate. And this is what's called the likelihood. And I will demonstrate the typical assumption for the functional form for the likelihood here in a second. But this is an inverse probability, right? This is not saying what's the probability I've measured some given lambda, measured a value of lambda given the data. It's rather saying what's the probability of observing the data I saw given lambda. And they're related, of course, to Bayes' theorem, and it depends on the priors for lambda, which we've talked about, but now I will actually write down. This is the prior on lambda. And what this could mean is, for example, imagine that you didn't believe neutron stars could be less than 1.1 solar masses because you have some stellar evolution model that says, hey, there's just no way that you can ever make a neutron star below that. In principle, our data could support models that have neutron stars below 1.1 solar masses, but if you add that additional constraint as a prior, in general, it will probably restrict the sort of freedom for other parameters that you're measuring. So it is an important thing to keep in mind. Generally speaking, in LIGO, we of course are extremely clear about our priors, not because we have some deep-seated result or deep-seated belief in something necessarily, but because we want people in the community to be able to interpret what we've done. Usually speaking, we try to do analyses with fairly broad priors, priors that are sufficiently broad that they're not actually the main thing that's constraining the result. So a lot of what comes out is almost intentionally mostly driven by the data. But you can do more things with LIGO if you're willing to, for example, take the neutron star merger and say that you believe that the masses need to really be close to 1.35 solar masses, you'll get different answers. So the goal of all of this would be to produce a posterior distribution on lambda, which you'll see in the literature. And if we take the simple case that lambda is equal to chert mass, this is sort of an easy thing to visualize. It's a one-dimensional distribution, so P of chert mass given data. This is kind of what we did yesterday, but we didn't evaluate the probability. We evaluated the a single point estimate. In actual fact, the most likely value turned out to be pretty close to what you get from the full Bayesian inference. But our entire goal here is to produce some posterior distribution that in general is going to be in this high dimensional space. So every time you see a LIGO result, you have to remember that actually we're solving for some large vector of parameters. It could be 8-dimensional, it could be 15-dimensional, all at once. Oftentimes what you'll see plotted is the other dimensions integrated out. So this is a process called marginalization for people that know about that sort of thing. And so sometimes you'll even see these sort of simple one-dimensional histograms. But when you see something like this, we really have explored the full probability space for lambda to take into account all of the correlations in the waveform that would come in from all of the physical parameters of modeling.
How do you do, so given a waveform, you don't necessarily know, like it could be two black holes, it could be three black holes, it could be two neutron stars in a black hole, right? There are a lot of different, you know, possible like framework, there are a lot of different possible frameworks and vectors of lambda that you want to use too. Do you just kind of do trial and error in that sense? Or do you have some sort of systematic way of kind of sampling different possibilities?
So we, I don't know, this may be false. I don't think anyone has actually tried to do a triple system.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a...
You mean numerically?
In terms of data analysis. That sounds hard squared.
So. What you can do is just take in, if you had a simulation, just compute in the Bayesian evidence.
You could do this, yes.
And then see which model is better over the other one.
You could do this. We've not, I think, ever considered seriously a triple system.
Well, then I mean, even if you just assume it's a binary system,
yes.
You at least have what, three possibilities: two black holes, two neutron stars, a black hole, and a neutron star. Right?
Good. So that's an excellent question. So this is really quite relevant. So for the most part, for neutron stars, for example, treating the system as two point particles, or another way of saying it, two black holes.
Mm-hmm.
Is actually pretty accurate. And so we tend to, as the first order pass, not include any finite size effects in the neutron stars. So our basic parameter summation really works with the picture that they're binary black holes. Now, in the case of GW170817, which was a neutron star merger, which we would have guessed even from the gravitational wave signal, but was sort of a dead giveaway when we found gamma rays. For that, we did an analysis which includes the finite size effects of the neutron star. They come in, I mean, this won't have much meaning in what I'm about to say unless you've studied it. They come in at like the fifth order in the post-Newtonian expansion. So it's a very, very, very high level correction of the dynamics. But it is a good question. So the one thing though that where it would matter more. And so this is where it's a little more delicate, and this is actually quite an important point. The spin prior is probably the bigger thing. So a black hole, if you use the Kerr parameter to determine spin magnitude, in a dimensionless sense, you can go up to one. That's typically how people put it. Neutron stars are almost always going to be lower than that. It's an equation of state dependent thing, but they can't spin as fast as a black hole without breaking up. So you do get different answers quite a bit if you restrict the spin prior. And usually when we have a low mass system, we do it both ways. So we restrict the spin prior to be more consistent with neutron star observations, but also allow it to be free running. And in fact, the neutron star paper quotes both, and I'll show it. Good question.
Sorry.
Yeah.
How sure can we be that these events that we detected are not boson stars or other kind of stuff? Like, can we say that these were for sure like 100% black holes and neutron stars? Or?
So the answer to that question, rigorously, you would still want to basically apply the same formalism here. Now, there have been tests, for example, for non-GR effects, and they come back that we'd have no evidence against GR. If you had a boson star scenario that could, for example, exactly map to, or at least close enough map to changes in GR, normal GR parameters, that's gonna be tough to measure. And it may go unnoticed in an analysis like this. You could, if there is some discriminating power there, you would essentially have to rework this inference, but including that additional power. But the bottom line is the GR templates for black holes fit extremely well for everything we've said. We have no evidence of this excess residual. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about how we approach data analysis, and it's going to be kind of a very short demo given that we don't have much time. So in LIGO, we essentially assume that the data is a linear combination of noise and some gravitational wave strain, where that gravitational wave strain amplitude could essentially be zero. But we assume that we can write the data as a linear combination of noise plus gravitational wave strain. The plot you're looking at, I mean, that assumption looks actually pretty reasonable. I know some of you asked me about that the other day. But if you look, you know, even a little further into sort of the clear chirp signal, you can see extra wiggles. And the sort of height of those wiggles looks like the noise that you're seeing earlier in the data. So really, you are just seeing a superposition of some noise process on top of the gravitational wave. Now, one of the key assumptions that happens in not only LIGO data analysis, but a lot of, I think, similar signal processing endeavors is the assumption of stationarity of the noise, which turns out to be pretty critical for a lot of the things that we talk about when we talk about in LIGO. And it's actually not quite right, but I'll get to that in a second. It only took me to the third day to learn. The assumption of stationarity is the following. Let me explain it in words and then draw a picture, and then there will be a little bit of math. In words, what it means is that we assume that that this process that's creating this noise doesn't depend on absolute time. So the general statistical properties of the noise are the same today as they are tomorrow. Not true. But over some time scale, it's pretty good. And over the time scale that we often do LIGO data analysis, it's usually a good approximation, but I'll talk about that more later. There can still be a non-trivial statistical richness to the data, but it has to take the following form if that's to be true. Let me just draw a picture first. Imagine you to take some snapshot of the LIGO noise. And if you looked at raw data, you'd see it's this sort of low, slowly varying, wiggly thing. If you were to take another plot of the data some other time, you'd see also that it's sort of some slowly varying thing. Now, of course, the two data sets will look entirely different. When we talk about the statistical properties of noise, we can't predict a priori exactly what the form of the noise is. But we can say something about the noise nevertheless. And what we can say when we have stationary noise is if we were to look at some instant of time, it doesn't matter where it is, because the point is it's time independent. We look at some instant of time. What we can say with some statistical certainty is the value of the data that is adjacent to it. So here, or here. And it sounds like it's, I don't know what it sounds like. If you know about this, then you're like, oh yeah, of course, that's obvious. If you don't know this, then you're like, what is he talking about? If you think about data that has a lot of low frequency noise, if you imagine drawing it, like you're gonna see a lot of low frequency sinusoids, right? As soon as I say that out loud, you would be surprised then, if this is what data normally looks like, if your data came along and looked like this, instead, we would all agree that's shocking, right? That's not what LIGO data looks like, or that's not what whatever data you're looking at looks like. That's different, all right? Good. So there, you've just proven to yourselves that there's a possibility of sort of statistically figuring out something about the data that makes sense. Essentially, we can characterize the relative, the probability of getting a given data point as a function of time delay. It doesn't matter what our reference time is, we can pick any point in the data. But this notion that, you know, you have some expectation for how the data looks can be entirely captured by the fact that you can work out a probability distribution for adjacent samples and basically a two-point function that works out the probability of getting these two samples versus these two samples versus these two samples, et cetera. And that distribution will capture what your brain is telling you when you see that these sets of data look different than these ones.
I think I'm going to ask something. Why is the H being compared to an R's?
Sorry about that. I was just too excited about drawing that second noise. Really happy. So what this would really mean is if I wanted to write down the probability of getting two noise samples, this is only going to depend on the probability of their difference. And that is sort of mathematically describing what stationary noise means. Now, I only bring this up because in some sense it's like, why are you boring me with all of this? Because it's actually fundamental to one of the things that you'll see when you look at LIGO results, when you look at LIGO signal processing notebooks, if any of you have played with them or whatever, and that's the concept of the power spectrum. And for the cosmologists in the room, there is in fact a deep relationship in stationarity versus assumptions in cosmology about the CMB, for example. But it means that we can characterize this, what would normally be a two-dimensional distribution that could be, you know, completely different depending on where, what piece of data you got, into something that really can be characterized entirely in a one-dimensional way that just describes differences between two noise samples. And so you'll see then that we work with something called the power spectral density, or PSD. And, you know, it's abbreviated often as this. And first thing to note, I don't know why it's S sub N. I really have no idea. That's like goes back before me. Huh?
Spectral.
Spectral, I guess, and then N for noise, sure. First thing you notice, it's in the frequency domain. Now, why is it in the frequency domain? It's already kind of interesting. So it needs to be in the frequency domain because it turns out that this magical relationship between a two-dimensional thing going to a one-dimensional thing that only depends on the differences. You might imagine doing some sort of change of variables to make this more explicit as a single parameter, right? And quantifying that probability distribution with some new parameter is actually done by converting to the frequency domain. So things which are sort of diagonal in the frequency domain, they're just a function purely of f with independent points, have a form where in the time domain they only depend on time differences. And you can convince yourself of that probably with many different ways, but if you were to write down a covariance matrix that had this form, it took the form of a Toeplitz matrix, you could sort out that the Fourier transform diagonalizes it. For those of you that know such a thing or care.
Two questions. One,
yeah.
Is N a noise index or
noise?
Index? Okay.
Noise. It just means noise. This is just a convention in the field.
Okay.
S sub N. Like this is what you'll see in the literature. And I assume that it means noise. Power spectral density. So you'll see this. And the thing I'm trying to say is that function under the assumption of stationarity captures all of the statistical properties of the noise. And the way I kind of like to define this is sort of silly, but what it's really doing is this. By the way, if any of you check these definitions super carefully, it's almost certain that one or more of the expressions I will present in the next 15 minutes will be missing a factor of two somewhere. There are conventions about this that drive me nuts. They drive everyone in the field nuts, and so I've given up. What the PSD is really capturing is that if you take some very simple concept of the statistical properties of the noise, the variance. So if I just hand you some data, and you have some collection of points, like for example, the data that you've been given in that handout, you have a discretely sampled set of data or a continuously defined one, either way is fine. But you can compute the variance. So you can compute sigma squared. And by the way, this is not the variance, obviously. It's only the variance if the mean is zero. So that's another thing I'm going to assume, mean is zero. So when I say this is the variance, that's only true if the mean is zero. You can always make the mean zero. So we'll always just know that the mean is zero. This is a sort of silly way to define it, but it's really saying that what we're talking about here is that the power spectral density is the thing that if you integrate it over this function of f, you just get back the variance of the noise. And so you can imagine then that, of course, what this is telling you is the variance in some small frequency region. So in the Fourier domain, in the frequency domain, the power spectral density is telling you the variance of the noise as a function of frequency. Okay? So LIGO data, if I showed you this, and you know, we could put some units on this, but I know there are no units, but relative to certainly to this, what would you expect the properties of the power spectrum to be in this versus this? That'd be a good quiz to see if you've understood. This is a time domain. So if you think of just summing up sine waves, you know, higher frequency sine waves or lower frequency sine waves? For this, like if you had to describe the noise in sine waves, higher frequency or lower frequency than this?
Higher.
Higher, good, good. You're all like, I don't know. What is he talking about? Just bear with me here. Good, higher frequency. So the properties of this you would say are that there's a higher frequency component to this noise. Okay? I don't think so. I think I've made it pretty clear that there's more high frequencies. I can add more cycles.
No, I mean, that one is more irregular than the high frequency ones.
Sure, but you still have like bigger amplitude oscillations with longer periods.
Yeah.
So is that reasonably clear to people?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So the power spectrum for this sort of data would have a bigger contribution at lower f, right? Whereas the power spectrum for this sort of data would have a bigger contribution at higher f, or maybe this, yeah. The way I've drawn it, if I were to guess, I'll tell you what, see how well I'm doing at this. Maybe you guys can digitize these later and take the FFTs and see how well I do about doing it in my head. I would guess that the power spectrum for our, if we call this A and B, the power spectrum for A, as I've written it, as I've drawn it rather, is maybe something like that. Maybe we got a peak at low frequency and a peak at a slightly higher frequency. Good? Power spectrum for B would maybe be like that. A delta function at some high frequency. All right, good. Now you know everything you need to know about signal processing. Okay. So this is pretty important because this is baked into essentially every single bit of math that you will see from here forward about how we do inference and searches. So we can define this likelihood function which is, remember, the other the thing on the other side of base there, not the thing we're ultimately looking at for, but the thing that we can compute. Under the Gaussian noise hypothesis, as this. I'll explain what all these mean here in a second. So data tilde as a function of f is just if I imagine instead of working in the time domain, which I'm not writing explicit parentheses t there, but you could imagine I could have put in a t everywhere. A Fourier transform, because normally you think of the data in the time domain, what I handed out is time domain. If I transform it to the Fourier, if I transform it with a Fourier transform, I'm going to write a tilde above it because it is, of course, a different function of f. And the key part here is we evaluate this likelihood in the Gaussian noise hypothesis where you have Gaussian stationary noise, which is why this power spectrum comes in here at all, because we know that all of the noise statistical properties, the variance, only depends on f. So normally this would be a two-dimensional integral, or if you were doing discrete mathematics, it would be a matrix. There'd be a matrix here to describe the statistics, even in Gaussian noise. Here, it's a one-dimensional thing because the Fourier transform is a sort of diagonal basis for describing stationary noise. Yeah.
Is
the isotope
under the integral?
It is not under the integral.
So you should have a leftover f. Under do I mean is it being integrated?
It is being integrated.
Okay. So
and the M tilde is the Fourier transform of what the model.
That's exactly right. So I'm getting to that right this second. So M in this case is something that we as data analysts have to propose. So I've used M as short for model. The point is we have a gravitational waveform as a function of frequency, and it also, of course, is a function of some set of binary parameters lambda. And those are ultimately the parameters we're looking to pull out of the data. So we can evaluate this, and you can see how this is going to work, right? If what is in your data is essentially just the m lambda f, right, then this subtraction gives you what? Zero. Yeah. Like, is it a trick question? I'm not trying to be tricky. This would give you zero. You know, I think I've forgotten a negative sign, haven't I?
One-half?
There's probably a one-half, yeah. It's a long story. Because it depends on how you define this, too. And if I write down something with too much confidence, I'd rather just say, if you really want to do this carefully, you're going to have to track down the twos yourself. Because it does depend on how, so you have to check what, if you can't take for granted that someone's given you the right one of these. So you need to really work it out yourself. It probably is inconsistent with that, you're right. So you probably need a one half. So if you would like, I can put this.
It's okay, up to you.
Okay. If you want, I'll put the two there. I haven't given you integration limits either, so watch out. I could do a lot with that. Didn't say I was integrating over negative frequencies. Okay. Sorry, I promise you, it is more annoying than, it's annoying, because even if you pin it down for yourself, you then have to make sure people are giving you the right things. Okay, so the point here is, this thing is going to be big when you've got zero here. I mean, biggest it can be, at least. And otherwise, it's going to be really small. And so, you know, even in sort of undergraduate labs, right, you were probably asked to do a chi-squared fit to some model, right? Like, you know. Make a line go through some points and find the minimum chi-square. Who knows? Who has no idea what I'm talking about? You're all like, I don't know, man. I don't know. For all I know, it's gibberish. But you can kind of see this is going on here, right? Like, it's really at the root, in fact, of what that particular test is doing, what chi-squared test when you do a fit. But the point is like, when the model fits the data well, you're subtracting it out, the residual is small, that thing is going to be big. So we say the data is more likely to support these values of lambda when this residual is small. Okay? That's the game.
Intuitively, I feel like you should want to have data minus the quantity model plus some estimate of the background. Are you just assuming that, is the assumption that that kind of time averages to zero, or?
It's a good question. The assumption is that all we possibly know about the data is contained in here, and there's really no way of adding another term up here that's going to make it better. Now, you can ask, is that right? And the answer is no. Of course, none of the simple stuff is ever right. And in fact, there's a great example in LIGO that's happening right now, which is why we're taking so long on some of the O2 results. Smart people figured out that there is actually a component of the noise that can be written down exactly. And can be removed. So, but that is really, you can think of it almost as a change to the definition of the data, which is how we approach it. because it's a dependent model. So there is a essentially a redefinition of data that subtracts out unknown n. But it's a good question. But when I write it like this, I'm assuming that, you know, that's it, we're done. This is as good as we can, which is usually the case. Okay. Now, I just want to make a couple of remarks on this because, like I said, I'm going to try to just introduce you to a few topics and let you ask questions in case there's some burning questions out there. I'm glad you are asking questions because we won't be able to cover everything that I still had left in the lecture. This is how, this combined with the priors is how we ultimately get out information about the data. Now, there are some assumptions that go wrong on occasion, which I'll talk about here in a little bit. But I want to point out something that's important, which is that generally speaking, this thing is a high dimensional calculation. So even if lambda has only 8 parameters, which it has more than that, because I haven't even talked about the parameters with respect to the binary's orientation with respect to LIGO, which adds a bunch of new extrinsic parameters. Evaluating this exhaustively in the entire lambda space is very non-trivial. And of course, it's a common problem for people that do any other inference things. You know all about this, but if you want to evaluate a function from data in, you know, 8-dimensional space or something like that, a gridded approach won't work, right? Like, let's say you can parameterize your lambda in 100 points in each dimension. Well, now you're talking about 100 to the 8 functions to test, right? So various techniques have to be used to do this. I don't want to go deeply into that, but the main point I want to make is that at least right now, it's not really computationally feasible to sort of analyze all possible LIGO data this way. And what I mean by that is you've got the plots in front of you, right? That's 200 milliseconds of data. We have years of data. So even if you want to go off and analyze that little stretch of data exhaustively, you've got to do it again for the next 200 milliseconds, and then again for the next 200 milliseconds. And then again, for the next 200 milliseconds, you get the idea.
What's the approximate time scale for just like one vector lambda to compute n?
It really depends a lot. So, and in fact, you kind of said what you thought was the dominant cost because you said m. Evaluating this function, of course, just evaluating this integral itself has cost, but in addition, this thing might be expensive to evaluate. For many cases, we have like essentially closed form functions of frequency for the m. So they're as fast as any closed form function of frequency could be evaluated. I mean, there are trig functions and things. But in general, this integral, even if m is free, is non-trivial if you're going to do it a billion times. So, that's where the cost is. The cost is doing this integral billions and billions of times, plus potentially each one of these is expensive to evaluate. For example, if every time you wanted an m, you had to go ask a friend who does numerical relativity or someone in this room give you a new m, then let's say they tell it'll take you a week, and you want to evaluate a billion of these, then you're looking at a billion weeks, right? That's not fair. Okay, so in actual fact, we do something for detection that is inspired by this, because in principle, this would get us most of the way towards not only being able to measure parameters, but also evaluate just the probability that anything in the data is there at all, right? Which is ultimately our first question. We have some data, does it contain a signal or not? We could use this formalism to do that, we don't, but we use something that's derived from it. So if we take a look at this expression, and imagine doing, taking the log of it, so getting rid of that exponential, and redefining something just for simplicity. How's that for a symbol, right? I figured you guys would hate this. I hated it when I was doing it, but I couldn't find any other way out. It's kind of nice. I mean, it's sort of.
Just switch to Mandarin alphabet, that's all.
What's that?
Switch to Mandarin or something.
Yeah, exactly, right? I don't know.
Can
This is going to simplify me being able to keep around less terms. I'm just going to go ahead and redefine. If you see this little hat over, I've basically divided out by the square root of the power spectral density. So it's pretty clear that if I were to do that for each of these terms, I get rid of the denominator. So in this case,
is SNF necessarily new?
Good question. Yes. Do you want more of an explanation for that?
No, just to make sure you can absorb it into magnitude without...
No, you're right. It is necessarily real. And in fact, of course, if the gravitational wave's output is real in the time domain, which means that the imaginary and real components are degenerate even in the Fourier transform too. So a lot of simplifications happen. But yes, it's real. Okay. So we can evaluate something that we call log of this lambda as the integral of these new parameters, df minus m of f comma lambda. So where we just get rid of that Sn of f. And in actual fact, this is equivalent to a similar expression in the time domain. So if we transformed back to the time domain, sorry, there should be an F here. We could essentially redefine what we mean by data and redefine what we mean by model to have essentially this frequency dependence of the noise removed by doing this transformation. But we can go back to the time domain with the Fourier transform. Those things are equivalent because of, I think, Parseval's theorem. Parseval was the first to point out that the Fourier transform was unitary, I guess. So that you can do it this way. So my point with this was that you can kind of get now back to a picture where you're working again in the time domain. And even if you have some sort of non-trivial noise statistics, as long as you're willing to make, as long as they're stationary and you're willing to make this transformation where you've sort of redefined what you mean by data and model, then some of the math gets easier and it'll be easier for the rest of the lecture. So I just wanted to do that. Because I don't want to be keep...
To inverse Fourier transform
instead of that. Inverse, so the good news about Fourier transforms and inverse Fourier transforms is, while you might be annoyed if asked to do one on pen and paper, computers are pretty good at it. So there are known algorithms for doing Fourier transforms that are very fast. Okay, so we could very well then in the time domain model imagine that what we're really working with is something like this. And I've lost my notes, but I can remember what I was wanting to do here anyway. So if you look at this expression and you imagine expanding it out, just FOIL, you know? That's all I mean. I want to make sure that this is what I wanted to come to next, sorry. Yeah, okay. So I could write this as the integral of 2 m hat lambda times d hat minus d hat squared minus m hat squared of lambda. So I've absorbed the minus sign in. And here we have two positive definite things. It's real. So because I switched the time domain, gravitational wave theta is real. We have two positive definite things here. That's going to always just make this expression smaller. The way we make this expression big is this. Does everyone agree with that? Okay. So in actual fact, if we wanted to write down a way of quickly determining, if there's a bigger likelihood in the data, we could sort of simplify this process by introducing this new parameter, which we'll call rho. That's why I didn't use rho for mass density earlier. Someone was complaining. As this. And I'll even drop the 2 because obviously the 2 doesn't matter if you're just trying to come up with some new parameterization. This rho is something that tells us when the data is more likely to contain the model m hat. Everyone good with that? Like, all I've tried to do is just come up with a way of pulling out a parameter from this full expression for the likelihood under the assumptions that we've given, where this, the value of this integral, the bigger the better.
Sorry.
Yes.
A minus sign there.
Yes.
There is a minus sign there.
Because of the log of the exponential, right?
Yes. Sorry. Thank you. Then this is the correct though. Yes. Thank you. Good. Thank you for catching that. Yes.
So if you have d hat equals n hat plus m hat, and here you have d hat minus m hat, the log likelihood is integral of d hat minus m hat.
Yes.
It looks like you're saying the log likelihood is equal to an integral of the noise.
Yes. When what's in the data is exactly what you're looking for. So that my data here, this was an h, right? So I don't know what h is. If h is exactly m, then you're right. But in general, h won't be m. And in fact, the log likelihood will be lower because of that.
Okay.
All right, anyone recognize this? It's a famous equation written in a funny way from LIGO. Not just LIGO, it goes way before LIGO. You'll know the term when I say it. This is the matched filter. I don't know if people were shocked or if you're like, yeah, whatever, that was obvious. Or, raise your hand if you're shocked, raise your hand if it was obvious. then I cover all possible cases. And I can just continue to be blissfully unaware. So rho is the matched filter. Now normally you see this in different ways, but this is a realistic time domain implementation of the matched filter that's actually used for real-time analysis of multi-messenger astrophysics. So this is a relevant way of looking at it. Now, the thing I want to motivate, and it's super handy that we did this weird transformation, with taking out the SN of F, because the noise has really nice properties, and I can explain it super easily without a bunch of extra matrices and things. My claim is that in that form, rho is measuring the signal-to-noise ratio, which is literally the power of the signal divided by the power of noise, well, the amplitude of the signal divided by the amplitude of the noise in an absolute value sense. And that's something you might want to know to see if you've got something in the data. So here's how we prove that. I always do this. So we'll make a couple of other simplifying assumptions, which don't really change anything, but make all the math a lot easier. Actually, I'll have to explain. Give me a second. First, imagine, okay, so another thing. That's an integral, but you agree that in the standard sense, that's the scalar product between two vectors in the time domain. Like if you're thinking quantum mechanics, right, that's like two two vectors, you're taking the inner product between those two things. Granted, it's real, not complex. If you imagine doing this, if you converted this sum to a, you converted the integral to a sum, these things are discrete quantities of time, then that integral is literally like the dot product of two vectors of time. Everyone good with that? Because in reality, that's what we do. So the LIGO data is in fact discrete. So, and in fact behaves like you would expect a vector space to behave for the most part, right? So when I write things like m dot m, you can imagine doing that integral. If that's what you like, you could imagine like doing a vector dot product between discrete time samples. There. All right. So first of all, I'm going to go ahead and just define that my m as written dotted with itself is one. So it's a unit vector, all right? And this means that I really, to sort of be a little bit more consistent, will slightly redefine how I define data. Because I, of course, in the gravitational wave data, can have any amplitude of gravitational wave for a given model. If I make this a unit vector, I'm stripping out its amplitude information. So I'm just explicitly adding back the amplitude as A. Everyone good with that? Because the gravitational wave data could have any amplitude. Good. So now, the beautiful, beautiful thing is that this data transformation that seemed to you to be just like me screwing with you has actually done something very powerful to the data and then ultimately to the noise, since part of the data is noise. And it's whitened the data, which means the statistical properties of the data now have the properties of white noise. And that's good because it's really easy to write that down. So what this means is that if I were to take, if I think of these as the noise terms as vectors, so what I mean by these lower indices is like a sample I and a sample j of a given set of noise. This has the property that it is now a Kronecker delta for the expectation value. It is still a statistical thing in the sense that, you know, I don't know ever exactly what the product of two noise samples are, but on average, what this means is that the only time the expectation value for two points of noise is non-zero is if the noise points are the same. So ni with ni, the expectation value is that it's one. Otherwise, the expectation value is that it's zero. So the noise has been transformed into a place where there's no correlation at all between the noise points. That just makes a lot of simplification in a lot of the various math. We still have the property that the probability of some given point is Gaussian noise, but it's no longer a correlated I'll write it over there. It's no longer correlated data. You don't need a covariance matrix to describe it. The probability of a given noise sample is just a standard Gaussian with variance 1. So any given noise sample is Gaussian distributed, mean 0, variance 1, and uncorrelated with anything else. Okay? This transformation has made that possible. Now, the price you've paid is that your models are now these weird transformed things, but it's a straightforward thing to do. You literally just do the things we did over there.
Do I care?
You do care. Thank you. Okay. Now, the rest of this then becomes super easy. So, if we were to try to evaluate this integral, which is a dot product, here, what we're going to do is evaluate it for a bunch of possible models. And I apologize, I guess I should have maybe used a different index. I can switch to like a Greek index if that's helpful. Not that this has any meaning like it does in GR, but I'm not talking about time here. I'm talking about you can evaluate the signal to noise ratio for a bunch of different models where you choose some discrete set of lambdas and figure out the one that produces the biggest row. This is essentially what we're doing in a matched filter search for light. Given the definition of D, hat, thank you. If you calculate the expectation value of rho alpha in noise using all of this information, and I guess the additional thing that we've explicitly said before, but I will write down on the board, the noise is mean zero. The expectation value for rho is m hat lambda I dotted with n hat plus a m hat lambda, thank you, alpha dotted with m hat lambda. And what I'm going to do here is I'm actually going to put in the data lambda star as some unknown signal. The dot product of something with a Gaussian is something you can prove if you want. If this thing's normalized, the expectation value, I should put brackets over around all of this, for this term is zero. So this ends up being less than or equal to A. This term can only be one if lambda alpha is lambda star. The unit vectors in general, that term will be less than one from the triangle inequality. Now, we know the variance of the noise is zero, but of course, or sorry, not the variance, but the mean. But of course, the variance of the noise is not zero. So if, in fact, we had A equals zero, which is the case where there is no gravitational wave, so noise only, then we end up, we could evaluate the case of rho squared expectation value, which is going to be the variance if the expectation value of rho is zero, which it is in noise. And for this, if we do this math, setting A equal to zero, we get
so you said the expectation value of m dot n hat dot n hat was zero.
Yes.
And so then you set a to zero.
Yes.
And so both of those pieces, you're squaring zero to one.
Yeah, the expectation of square is not squaring
the expectation. Sorry, I didn't hear the comment over here.
Expectation of square is not the square of expectation.
Yes, that is true. So I'm squaring everything inside the angle brackets. But I think that comes out to one, right? I have this algebra in here if we want to redo it, but we don't have a ton of time. So the point is that, in fact, this measurement, if you imagine that lambda alpha and lambda star are the same, we really have measured something where if we measure A, we're measuring the signal-to-noise ratio. Because we can also evaluate the variance when A is not zero and we pick up an A squared. Okay, so that was matched filtering from parameter estimation. I just wanted to point that out to people. We're basically almost out of time. I thought before when we ended, we would discuss a little bit about some of the results. I want to show you how some of this stuff actually turns out in the end. So when LIGO does searches for gravitational waves from compact objects, we actually start with this. We evaluate rho alphas, wherever those are, for potentially millions of different models, each with a different lambda. Now we choose those models so that they're sufficiently close that if we have the actual signal we're looking for in the data, that value is always at least close to measuring the true amplitude of the gravitational wave, within a few percent. Once we've identified something interesting in the data, we then are able to go back and evaluate the parameters, possibly taking into account a bigger parameter space. This procedure is essentially all we can really do computationally, but it does have issues. The main issue that it has is that we are almost always sacrificing some of the physics by doing a restricted set of lambdas. In principle, we could miss gravitational wave signals on the first pass because of this restricted set of lambdas that go into the matched filtering, which means we'd never have a chance to be able to do parameter estimation at the end. Now, we don't really know how, in many cases it's been studied how that might affect things, and there are a couple of places that we know that it's a problem, but obviously we've been able to manage decently well. So I wanna show you just a little bit of LIGO results that you've probably mostly already seen and talk through them in the context of what we've learned so far. Can we have the screen down, please?
Touch your shoes together.
There's no place like home. There's no place like home. Or not. We can talk about something else. There we go. Thank you. I don't know that the projector's all the way there. It goes. Okay, so when we do a LIGO search, this is not true for all LIGO searches, by the way, but it's true for the compact binary searches. We lay down a grid of possible models, lambda sub alpha. We evaluate this matched filter. We identify interesting candidates. There's a whole topic that we didn't get to cover, which is non-stationary noise. Basically, why so many things I just said were a lie. Let me give you a sense of why it's not totally a lie. In general, LIGO data can sort of be decomposed if we were to try to write it slightly differently. If I take this as my LIGO data, the non-stationary component of LIGO data can be pretty adequately described by adding some other thing into the data with some other amplitude, where this X is a bit of non-stationary noise. The way we treat it is very much like how we would treat a signal, but not a gravitational wave signal, instead like a signal of seismic noise or something like that. And this component is obviously not the same as the noise, but to an excellent approximation, the notion that LIGO noise is Gaussian stationary is true. Certainly over time scales relevant for measuring gravitational waves. So I don't want to mislead you. But where a lot of people go wrong with LIGO data is that there's also a population of these things, which colloquially we call glitches. And the problem historically is that there are way more of these than there are of actual gravitational waves, right? And so even though there aren't so many of these that we have to throw out our assumptions about the noise, in my opinion, there are still so many of these, the average person out there who's looking at the data might think, there are so many things that are non-stationary, they must all be gravitational waves. And that would not be an accurate categorization. Now the good thing is that, and we didn't have time to talk about it, that these things tend to not be correlated between gravitational wave detectors. And this is one of the primary reasons why we spent money to build two instead of one gravitational wave detectors in the US. So you expect, roughly speaking, these to look the same in the LIGO detectors, but these to be completely uncorrelated. Could we get the lights dimmed a little bit? I don't know how to do that. Thank you. Okay. Maybe this will work.
I'm loading the bar at the bottom.
I don't know what on earth is in it that's so large. Okay. So this is something that you all would have been familiar with from the very first gravitational wave detection. And in fact, this is the signal that we analyzed by eye yesterday. So this is the very first gravitational wave detected from LIGO. It was a binary black hole, as we know, with a trip mass of about 30. And here you're seeing almost the raw data, like I'd mentioned before. The data's been bandpassed, which just means that essentially we've isolated the most relevant frequencies, but otherwise the data is unadulterated. Now, this is the predicted gravitational waveform with some uncertainty. Now, this model clearly goes beyond what we talked about in this class because you can see that it doesn't just keep inspiraling forever. There's a transition to a merger and eventually the gravitational wave radiation shuts off in what's called the ring down. So this was done using full numerical relativity to solve Einstein's equations without all of the simplifications that we just made. Nevertheless, we already found out that at least the beginning is qualitatively and to some extent quantitatively captured by what we did in this class. Here is the residual. So if you actually then were to imagine what the most likely point in this Bayesian parameter estimation is, you're integrating this. And this is, in fact, the smallest residual that's left over. So like taking all the GR hypothesis templates within our values of lambda that we consider in our prior space, the best fit is that. Subtracting it out leaves this. And I think hopefully by eye, you can see that what's left over just looks like a lot more of this. Okay. Now, just to remind you, units on the y-axis, 10 to the minus 21. That was the ratio of a person's height to the Milky Way. Here you can actually see some of the posterior PDFs that come out of this. Now the magic here, of course, is not to try to just find the best one. In some sense, that's what match filter does, to sort of see if there's something in the data. But in actual fact, you want to know what are the possible lambdas that are supported by the data, because we know the data has noise. So the best one is sort of an ill-defined concept, because noise will push around the best. So, of course, this is really a function of lambda. For every lambda you put in, you get an answer out. And when combined with Bayes' theorem, you can convert these, after possibly some integration over parameters, into posterior distributions on the binary parameters. This is how we extract the physics. This is the equivalent to what you've done by eye, except, you know, with computers.
So that straight line on the posterior,
yeah.
Is that coming from a prior?
Yeah. Well, kind of from a constraint, mm-hmm. where it's a definition. So M1 and M2 are symmetric, but we impose that M1 is greater than M2.
Oh, okay.
It's a good question. It makes for awkward plots. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to tell you. So here you can see a great example of the uncertainty in M1 and M2. And I have a graph that I'll get to here in a second that's even more striking. You can see that the two-dimensional probability is this, right? But the marginalized distributions for just measuring M2 and just measuring M2, like the projections onto these variables of these system terms. Clearly there's correlation there, right? There's a special function of these two masses that seem to really capture this posterior PDF. That function is the Chernyx. It's not as clear in this one as it will be in the neutron star case. In the neutron star case, it's remarkably clear. Parameters we didn't even talk about, but that are relevant, spin, magnitude, and tilt angle for the two black holes. Here we have, again, posterior PDFs. Color indicates how probable the value is. So the more green, I guess, or yellow, or whatever color this is, the more probable. How far it extends in here is the spin magnitude from 0 to 1. And then these are the angles with respect to the orbital angular momentum. This has a posterior probability for the spins that's quite consistent with either small spins or spins that, well, you can't really see it from this plot, but it turns out spins that are sort of anti-aligned with one another. It's not very clear from this plot. Also, I just want to keep in mind, I put these waveforms up there, right? Because again, all the information is coming from that. You propose a lambda, you get a waveform. You propose another lambda, you get another waveform, right? So those two waveforms at the top give you just some sense of the variation in the possible lambda space, right? The point is that some of those fit the data better than others, right? Clearly, in the case of this one, the lambda that has this fewer number of cycles is going to be the better fit.
So you have to do full numerical relativity for each of these?
No, that's an excellent question, and we could have gotten there a little, you know, if we had 10 more weeks. No. So in reality, we use a lot of different waveform models, and I don't want to undersell. I definitely do not want to undersell the importance of careful waveform modeling. Like, there's just no way that we could have attacked it in this particular 3-lecture course, but it is critical to our field. And in general, it's an interplay between people doing analytic approximations and numerical relativity, and essentially a lot of humans working on how to calibrate those things that come up with models that are simpler to evaluate but accurate. A couple of other PDFs we can also get from the waveform the distance, we can get the inclination angle, we can get the final spin and final mass, for example, of the black hole. There are lots of other ways we can slice this. It's a huge dimensional space we can look at. Tons of different two-dimensional plots. It's all coming from that. Some of the implications for GW150914, I mean, here's the thing, as we extract this physics, that's great. What does that mean? Well, it means a lot. In this case, it meant, first of all, this particular first signal was a lot heavier than what people thought should be expected. It implies, of course, that the progenitor stars were really big. If you're going to make 30 solar mass black holes, you better have a star that's at least 30 solar masses. It actually needs to be quite a bit bigger even than that, which was, you know, pushing the boundary of the size of stars that people typically thought were out there. Because of that, it couldn't have really shed much mass from stellar wind, and it lets us determine really what its environment was like. It had to have either been born in a low metallicity environment or in the recent universe, or it had to have merged from super early in the universe where there wasn't a lot of metal. So some of you may know what that is. Basically, like, the universe was born with, you know, mostly hydrogen, helium, a little bit of lithium. Stars make that all turn into heavier metals. Stars collapse, they fusion, you get carbon, all the way up to iron. And in supernova explosions, you can even get other heavier metals. That stuff gets recycled in the universe. The more metals that are around, it means that you affect the opacities of stars and stellar winds and actually consequently change stellar evolution for future stars. So we know from this event that this thing would have either been born early in the universe where there weren't a lot of metals or somehow in a place in the universe where there weren't a lot of metals.
How far away was this event?
400 megaparsecs. So pretty clear, pretty close by. We were able to actually use this to pin down rates of mergers of this type, which previously were only known to be somewhere between 0.1 and 300 per gigaparsecs cubed. After this event, we could say that they were between 2 and 400 per gigaparsecs cubed. So not that impressive. The rates are continuing to get better. I didn't even show updated ones because, frankly, the best ones are yet to be published. So keep an eye out this fall. But we're actually saying now with confidence, you know, that these merger rates exist and are pretty high. There was another event found at the same time that gets a little bit of press. The one thing we didn't have a chance to cover, and explaining this plot is much more complicated than what I just gave, but you can see some of the things show up. We got log likelihood, we got sync, like a row. These sorts of things, admittedly, are much more complicated than the analysis I just gave simply on the board. But the point is, the bigger of these values, the more likely something is to be a gravitational wave. GW150914 sits all the way out here with very big values. Our expectation from noise is that the noise falls off very sharply. So when we make a statement about how significant these sorts of things are, we can say things like, well, GW150914 has a log likelihood of nearly 80. By the time you get to 30, the probability that noise gives you this is 10 to the minus 8. Okay? So this is how we knew this. I mean, everyone knew this was super impressive and important, but statistically speaking, this is how we know that it was a confident 5-sigma detection, at least. There's another event, though, here. And this was published along with the paper. But at the time, we weren't really sure about what it was. But we suspected it might be another black hole. And now I think it's fair to say that the gravitational wave community has accepted this as another black hole. So we call this LVT151012. A much lower SNR event, detected about a month after the first one. Had we not detected this one, we probably wouldn't have paid any attention to this, because the gravitational waves existed was not very favorable. But now that we know they're there, we think this is a good solid signal. On Christmas Day in the East Coast, we detected the second confirmed binary black hole in 2015, which is GW151226. And it was similar, but a much lighter system. Here's the full numerical simulation. It lasted a full second in LIGO's band. It was not possible to see the signal on this. So here's where you really did need all of the fancier, not only signal processing to find it, but also to estimate its parameters. Dramatic, right? Dramatic. Whoa, I know. All right, so everything kind of, I'm going to keep you like 3 minutes over and you're going to deal with it. Everything changed. I don't feel that. Everything changed, you know, we detected a lot more black holes. I don't know, I shouldn't say a lot. A lot, well, I'll say a lot. We detected a lot more black holes. And that's all been great, a lot of fun. But then August of last year, we detected for the first time a binary neutron star merger. But the impressive thing about this is that along with the gravitational wave signal, which you can see here in a time frequency map, chirping upward in amplitude and frequency, we detected at the same time a gamma ray burst from two different instruments. And that's not all. We learned a ton of physics, which I'm happy to talk with you about some other day. We were able to constrain, for example, finite size effects of the neutron star, which spoke to the equation of state. We were able to pinpoint its location from gravitational waves alone, and about 10 hours later or so, an optical counterpart was discovered in a nearby galaxy 40 megaparsecs away. And from that, there was a ton of other observations. Each one of these little tick marks corresponds to a different, what's called a GCN, which is a gamma ray coordinate network, basically an email between partners looking at these sorts of things. So there was a ton of activity across the electromagnetic spectrum associated with this event. It was found in every electromagnetic band, effectively.
Were there neutrinos?
Yeah. Sadly not. Next time. Can't describe how this works, but an unexpected result, because we didn't think we'd get this lucky. Because we knew the redshift of the galaxy, we knew the distance from gravitational waves, we could actually get an estimate of the Hubble constant. Hubble constant, local, so for the expansion of the universe is R blue line here. It's much bigger than the leading things, but the good news is that it's at least consistent with the leading things. Maybe more on that in the future. Just want to quickly point out that LIGO's black holes seem a little bit different in terms of the observed population from the black holes that we've known from electromagnetic observations. So X-ray studies had found black holes. This is mass. And the size also indicates mass, a very degenerate plot. You can see that the black holes here that have been found through X-ray observations are relatively small. LIGO's black holes are big. It's almost certainly a selection effect of the experiments, but maybe not. Time will tell. I think this will be an interesting thing we'll uncover in the next few years. Are we seeing different populations, or are we just seeing selection effects? If we're seeing different populations, all kinds of crazy things could be true, is this it? The initial black holes, that's the Kerr parameter A, which have so far all been measured to be close to zero, except for GW151226, where we actually measured a non-zero of the initial black holes.
What's the uncertainty on the ones that are zero?
Big, 0.3.
Mm-hmm. Those are prejudices of what that should have been before you saw them.
Yeah. people didn't think they were zero necessarily, because people expected accretion and other things to spin them up. And from electromagnetic observations, admittedly, ones with their own systematic biases, the measured A's are sort of all everywhere between 0 and 1. So that's even a maybe more interesting story that could hint to a different population, that our spins are inconsistent. But again, it's just too early to say.
They're orbiting
You know, that's a very deep question that I will wait until after the class to answer. There's no real good way of pinning down these parameters in GR, but that's another story. So the one last thing I want to say is, we're going after crazy stuff too. So you should see, hopefully soon, a paper from my student that is testing one of the most crazy possibilities, which is that LIGO's black holes are somehow not stellar evolution, but primordial. The target we're looking for, because we think the cleanest possible signal, is to look below a solar mass, because we don't have any good stellar evolution models that predict black holes below a solar mass. If they're primordial, there's no reason to think they wouldn't be. And in fact, if you want to explain dark matter, and you want to make all of LIGO's black holes dark matter, and you want to use reasonable models, it might suggest that, in fact, the mass distribution peaks below a solar mass. So these are projections, but you're going to see a paper on this. This won't mean too much to you, but we're basically going to constrain the fraction of dark matter that's made up of primordial black holes below a solar mass. These are the LIGO results projected. This represents the best constraint so far, so we'll either detect something and I'll get more Nobel Prizes, or we'll be able to do better than the competing experiments for constraining primordial black holes. And that's all I've got. Thank you. You've been wonderful.
What's the time frame that goes with those projections?
So the first paper is going to be this one, and it'll be out in August. I shouldn't promise things like that. It's an LVC paper, so, you know.
Using data you already have.
Yes. Yeah. This is also a projection that would be for data we already have. We haven't searched it yet. So who knows? Yeah.
The fraction of the dark matter that is assumed to be, I'm sorry, I have no words. the fraction of dark matter isn't one, so it means that you cannot explain everything with the
At least not in that mass range, yes. There's a lot of assumptions that go into this, and if people want to hear it, I'll go into 1 minute, 2 minutes. Yeah, okay. Because it's a lot of assumptions. First, you'll recognize these curves. For those of you who are primordial black hole aficionados, I know there are at least a couple in the room. These curves from these other experiments and observations are pretty standard. You see them in, for example, Carr's review articles on this topic, typically over a much larger mass range. the assumptions that almost always go into these, and certainly the ones in this plot, is that all the dark matter is exactly at a monochromatic mass. So you don't think of this as a constraint on a function that is extended, but rather a delta function. So when you say that all of the dark matter, that only 10% of the dark matter can be this, you mean 10% can be one solar mass black holes, not 10% can be this. Now, that's just a point I want to point out because it's a very difficult thing, and even though it sounds like a simple thing to say, it hurts my head all the time when I try to interpret these plots. But to be consistent, we did the same thing. So our constraints are essentially monochromatic mass function constraints. The other assumption that goes into this is we used, because in order to constrain this, we need to form binaries. There are lots of different ways that you can do this. People propose different methods. The one we're using is the one proposed by Sasaki et al. It actually goes back way earlier into the 90s. I don't remember the first author of that paper, but Sasaki
Nakamura.
Was on it. Nakamura, thank you. So it's a really old calculation that's been around for a while. You believe it or you don't, but it's pretty straightforward to follow it. The idea is the universe forms a bunch of them at roughly the same mass. They're just free-floating things. They would, if you had two of them, they would crash together, but because there are a lot of them, three-body interactions put them into binaries. The binaries evolve according to gravitational radiation, and some fraction of them are observable today. So under that model, those are the projections we get. You change any of those assumptions and all bets are off. But we're trying just to see what comes out. I'm mostly interested in finding something. I don't care about the projections. Because if we find something down here, it may not be a primordial black hole. That would be cool. But it might just be a small neutron star. It might be something else. So we're just going to... I care about finding, not constraining. It's worth pointing out. Anything else?
The constraint's not very good, It's like the parable of the tap dancing snake. It's not that you do it well, it's that you do it at all, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, that's right, because that's the key in this, is that no one, this is an unprobed parameter space for LIGO until, we did it a while ago, like a decade ago, but haven't touched it in new data. So in my mind, this is a no-brainer. Unfortunately, it's kind of expensive computationally, so we're applying for lots of money. If anyone has any money they want to give us to do this, please talk with me after. Okay, well, thank you all again. Go have lunch.